Our Bible reading is Nehemiah chapter 1. Mark is going to start a new series of messages called God Rebuilds Us. And it's based on the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 1. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men. And I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, "Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws that you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man.' I was cupbearer to the king."
I want to invite you to picture this scene with me, if you can. It's the scene of Jerusalem in 445 BC. There's been a devastating, once-in-a-generation event that has changed every person's life for good. Life, as the people of Jerusalem know it, has come to an abrupt halt. Their lives are completely disrupted. Nothing looks the same anymore. Many of the older generation have died. The younger generation following them are starting to question their faith. Some of the people are trying to return to normal, to get back to normal life, but it's only a percentage of them. And there's just the sense that things aren't as good anymore as they once were. Imagine feeling all of those things. I mean, some of it really does ring true for us today, doesn't it? It sounds very familiar. Well, this is the context of the book of Nehemiah that we're starting to study today. And how the people of Israel, those people who are from Judah, seek to rebuild their devastated city of Jerusalem after this once-in-a-generation event has happened. It does seem like it's the perfect time for us to study it. A group of people looking to rebuild as we look to rebuild in many areas of our lives following the pandemic. This book of Nehemiah is the story of a discouraged people who nonetheless choose to be faithful, choose to put their trust in God no matter the cost. I think it's a perfect book for us to study at this time. So a bit of background before we dig in and before we start this series. Well, God's people, the Israelites, spent 450 years in captivity in Egypt as slaves. And you might know the story of how God used Moses and Aaron to set them free. And what we find is that having crossed through the Red Sea, they then have these decades of wandering around in the wilderness, in the desert. One generation of the Israelites pass away. And before they go to enter the promised land, Moses gathers the people together for a series of talks, a series of sermons. These sermons are contained in the book of Deuteronomy in our Bibles. And the word Deuteronomy literally means second law. It's a second time that God, through Moses, is giving the law to the Israelites. It's a bit of a team talk, if you like, gathering together just before they go into the promised land. And God, in the book of Deuteronomy, repeats his plans and his purposes for his people, for the Israelites. But contained in those plans and purposes is a bit of a warning for them. And God says this to them: after you have had children and grandchildren and have lived in the land a long time, if you then become corrupt and make any kind of idol, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord your God and arousing his anger, I call the heavens and the earth as witnesses against you this day, that you will quickly perish from the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess. You will not live there long, but will certainly be destroyed. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and only a few of you will survive among the nations to which the Lord will drive you. There you will worship man-made gods of wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or eat or smell. But if from there you seek the Lord your God, you will find him if you seek him with all your heart and with all your soul. When you're in distress and all these things have happened to you, then in later days you will return to the Lord your God and obey him. For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not abandon or destroy you or forget the covenant with your ancestors, which he confirmed to them by oath. It's an interesting warning, isn't it, to the Israelites? You know, here God is saying to them, you're about to go into the promised land, this land that I've always had for you. But God says to them, it comes with a warning, because if you forget me in that land, if you forget your relationship with me, if you start to worship other gods, if you start to turn to ways that aren't good, God says to them, I'm going to kick you out of that land. I'm going to exile you. People are going to come in and they're going to ransack the land and they're going to take you away from it. You know, it's a stark warning, isn't it? It's a frightening warning from God. But within that warning, and I've put it there in gold on the slide there, there's this word but. Because that isn't how it has to be all the time. Because God says to them, yeah, I'm going to kick you out. I'm going to discipline you if you ever do this. But there's a way back. If you seek me, you will find me. And I won't forget my promises to you. And I will come back for you. Well, if you know your Bible, you'll know this is exactly what takes place. They do go into the promised land. But they forget God. They start to worship other idols. They start to live lives that are totally anti the way God wants them to live their lives. And he allows another nation to come in and ransack the land. And that nation is the nation of Babylon. And you can see here on this map, all this green area here is the Babylonian Empire. They were the power in the land. And if you read the book of 2 Kings 25, you can read how the Babylonians come in, and they come in north of Israel, and they start to take over the country. And by 586 BC, Jerusalem is completely destroyed by the Babylonians. They don't destroy all the people. They take many of them, many of the best, the strongest, the most intelligent, the most creative people. They take them back to Babylon with them. And so there's a group of Israelites in Babylon who live in exile. For about 70 years they live in exile, and others of the Israelites are scattered all across the land. This is where the exile in Babylon, we pick up with the story of Daniel and his friends trying to live out an exiled life in Babylon. It's where Psalm 137 is written, by the rivers of Babylon, where we sat down. I tried to get Ian to include that in the worship this week, but he wasn't up for singing a Boney M song. But that's where that song comes from Psalm 137. When we were in exile in Babylon, we said, when we remember Zion, we remember Jerusalem and that land and everything that it meant to us. But God's good to his word. After 70 years, he does remember them. And the Persian Empire suddenly rises up, and they become the powerhouse in the area. And they take over the Babylonian Empire, and they allow the Israelites to start to go home. And so the exiles start to trickle back to Israel and to Jerusalem, bit by bit by bit, but not many. It's tough. They're returning to a land that's been ransacked. They're returning to a Jerusalem that's been burnt to the ground. They're trying to rebuild it, and it takes years, and it's tough. And that takes us to the year 445 and the life of Nehemiah and this book, which is almost like a journal that he kept of what it's like hearing about what's happened to Jerusalem and how they start to rebuild that city. At the start of the book of Nehemiah, we find him living in what is now Persia. It's not Babylon anymore. Remember, the Persians have come and taken it over, in their capital city, Susa. And Nehemiah has got a top job. We're told he's the cupbearer for the king. That means he's a trusted individual. He's got the ear of the king. He's with the king, a guy called Artaxerxes, a lot of the time. And his job was to check, as cupbearer, to check that no poison is in the king's food or within his cup. And while he's doing this job, while he's cupbearer for the king, Nehemiah's brother and some other individuals have travelled out to Jerusalem to see what's going on there. And they come back to Susa, to where Nehemiah is. And they report to him about what they have seen. And this is what it says. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, when I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some men. And I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province, that's the province of Jerusalem, and they're in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. And at that point, something stirs within Nehemiah. And we're told that he begins to weep and cry. This is the start of something incredible within Nehemiah and for the people of Israel. You see, that moment, that stirring within Nehemiah is the beginning of a rebuild and a renewal of God's chosen people and of the city of Jerusalem. At that point, everything begins to change. And there's so much for us to learn. So much for us to learn from Nehemiah's life and what he went through. You see, whilst we haven't had towns and cities destroyed and burnt to the ground during a pandemic, in many ways, much of our life has been destroyed. Much of the way that we used to live our lives isn't like that anymore. It feels like, in one sense, we're walking around rubble, doesn't it? And we're kind of looking, going, well, this isn't how it used to be. Well, we can learn loads from Nehemiah, and we can learn loads from his attitude and how he went about this rebuild. And there's just two things, quickly, I want us to think about today as we start this series, about how rebuilding starts, especially in chapter 1 of Nehemiah. And the first point is this, is that rebuilding starts with grieving. Rebuilding starts with grieving. And isn't that often the case? You see, it's obvious here, isn't it? As Nehemiah hears from his brother and from others about Jerusalem, he suddenly becomes aware of just how bad things are. It grieves him. It breaks his heart. Look at what it says. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and I fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Nehemiah here is a broken man. But what's incredible about this is that Nehemiah most probably would never have been to Jerusalem himself. He's never been to Israel. Remember, they've been in exile for 70 years. Nehemiah is a young guy. He's been born in exile. He didn't grow up in Israel. He didn't grow up in Jerusalem. But he's heard stories. He's maybe seen pictures of it that maybe some of those Israelites have painted in Babylon. And they said, well, this is what Jerusalem used to look like. He said some tell stories and sing songs, certainly the Psalms, about Jerusalem. But he's never been there himself. Yet he's knocked for six, isn't he? He's broken by what he hears. Look at the slowed down language here that it uses. I sat down and I wept. For some days I mourned. I fasted and I prayed before the God of heaven. The situation in Jerusalem doesn't directly affect Nehemiah, does it? He's got a great job. He works for the king in Susa, in the Persian capital. He's got a comfortable life. He's got everything he wants. Doesn't affect him. This is miles away. But it breaks him and he grieves. And listen, so often before a new thing can be built, before a new thing can start, we need to allow time to grieve and to mourn what is past. Before something new can be rebuilt, we need to allow time to grieve. Now the interesting thing is that sometimes our natural inclination can be to push any feelings of grief and mourning away, to ignore them. The reason we often do that is that they're uncomfortable. When we grieve, when we mourn, it's painful. It's not easy. Nobody looks for grief. Nobody looks to mourn, do they? Because it means we've lost something. We don't often invite loss and grief and mourning into our lives. And so when they come, when those feelings come, we see it as like an alien invasion. And we try and push it away and keep it away from ourselves. Nehemiah doesn't do that here. He hears what's going on in Jerusalem and he responds through grief. He doesn't ignore it. And that's important because God wanted to do something in Nehemiah as he grieved and as he mourned. If Nehemiah had heard that story and gone, well, that's pretty bad for the people in Jerusalem. That's kind of sad, isn't it? But anyway, on with my job. God wouldn't have been able to work in Nehemiah's life. But Nehemiah is clearly a man in touch with his emotions and feelings. He knows that he's been created with emotions and feelings. That he's made in the image of God, and those feelings are okay. And so he makes time and space to grieve. And because of that, God is able to work in his life. Now, as we face a rebuilding project, you know, here at the church, we need to rebuild. We need to rebuild our ministries. We need to rebuild what it means to meet and gather and to be a church that is able to be community together. As we face that, and as our nation faces a huge rebuilding situation to do with the economy and how we function after the pandemic, each one of us needs to make space to grieve and to mourn. To grieve and mourn the pandemic. Now that's been difficult because, again, a lot of our grieving and mourning and the usual way we do things, we've not been able to do. Funerals have looked different. We've not been able to have Thanksgiving services and other things like that. It's been difficult. But I want to encourage each one of us to just ask ourselves that question. Are there things I'm grieving? Are there things that I'm mourning? Things that I've lost over the last 18 months? And to acknowledge that. And just as Nehemiah did, to make space to grieve those things and to mourn those things and to acknowledge it. Because perhaps God wants to do something in me and you as we grieve and as we mourn. Recognize that God can work in those emotions and those feelings. Rebuilding often starts with grieving. But the second point for us today is that rebuilding also starts with prayer. You've seen what Nehemiah did. It's there on the screen. He mourned, he fasted, and he prayed for some days before the God of heaven. Now, one fascinating thing about this chapter, Nehemiah 1, is the gap that takes place between Nehemiah starting to pray and what happens at the start of chapter 2. I don't want to give the story away, but at the start of chapter 2, Nehemiah goes and he talks to King Artaxerxes about what is going on in Jerusalem. In between that, he's praying. But do you know what? There's a huge gap. There's a huge amount of time. 4 months. 4 months passes between Nehemiah starting to pray and going to see the king. When he hears about what's going on in Jerusalem, he stops and he seeks God. Now, I don't know about you, but when I hear that something bad has happened, when I hear that there's a problem, when I hear that there's an issue going on somewhere, often my first reaction is, right, what can I do about it? How can I fix this? If I was Nehemiah in this situation, if my brother had told me what was going on in Jerusalem, and if it had broken my heart, the first thing I'd be doing is going online and booking a flight to Jerusalem, saying, right, let's get there, let's do it, let's take a working party, let's get Jerusalem rebuilt, let's get these walls up, let's do everything we can to fix this problem. And Nehemiah doesn't do that. He stops for 4 months and he prays and he seeks God. Now there's huge wisdom in this, isn't there? And there's huge things that we can learn from this. By stopping and taking time, Nehemiah is realizing that maybe his first reaction isn't always going to be the best. My first reaction to situations, my instinct isn't always the right way to act. But sometimes I've acted and then I think, oh yeah, probably should have taken a bit more time. Nehemiah realizes that in stopping and slowing down, there's some wisdom. But bigger than that is that as he stops, he seeks God and he prays and he hears God's heart. For 4 months he hears God's heart. And God is able to direct Nehemiah along the right path. A great lesson for us to learn. When we hear about something, when we hear there's an issue, rather than acting, we stop. I was reading about a church recently who have lots of action groups serving their community, a bit like our church does. They've got lots of different ministries in serving the community. But they've got an interesting policy. If somebody comes to them, for example, and says, I want to do something about the homeless problem in our town, what the church will do is they'll gather people and say, who else? Who else thinks there's a homeless problem? Who else would want to help serve the homeless in our community? And maybe 50 people go, yeah, we do. And they'll say, right, let's come together, let's do something. But their policy is this, is that before they do anything, they gather those people and say, what we want you to do to start with is every week we want you to gather and to pray. For 6 months, we want you to gather and to pray once a week about the homeless problem. And of course, what they find is that not 50 people turn up, but maybe 20 people turn up. And they'll pray, and they'll pray, and they'll pray before they do anything. But what they find is that during that 6 months, they capture God's heart for the homeless. They feel his compassion for the homeless. And they also start to get his insight and his wisdom and his ideas for how best to serve the homeless. And of course, 6 months later, what they start doing for the homeless is often different to what they would have done 6 months earlier. They've stopped and they've taken time. We can learn from Nehemiah that rebuilding often starts with prayer. And so building a rhythm into our lives where we regularly stop and seek God and maybe sit in silence and seek him is so good for us, because it creates a habit within us and an instinct within us that that is what we do. And so rather than just activity, activity, activity and going on our own instinct, like Nehemiah, our first response is to stop and seek God. To persevere with prayer, sometimes for months. It's a good thing to do before we start rebuilding. But there's another thing about the way that Nehemiah prays as well. And that is, his prayer is specific as well. And rebuilding often starts with specific prayer. I love how Nehemiah prays in verse 11. He says, Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Look at what he says. Give your servant success today by granting him favour in the presence of this man. Now Nehemiah knows that he needs to go and talk to King Artaxerxes. He needs to go and talk to his boss. Because he can't just go off to Jerusalem without booking some holiday first with King Artaxerxes. But look at how specific he is. Grant me success today. He wants it to happen on that day, 4 months later. And not just grant me success today, but grant me success with this man, with the king who I need to go and see. And I think this is inspiring, because it's often not the way that you and I pray, is it? Often we'll pray and say, Lord, would you bless me? Would you just help me today? But I think there's something in how Nehemiah is so specific in what he requests God to do. You see, he recognises in that being specific and telling God exactly what he wants to do and what he wants to see happen is that he's saying to God, really, only you can meet these needs. Only you can do what I'm asking you to do. It's a real posture of dependence on God, saying, I want this to happen now and in this situation with this person. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? In the Gospels, in the stories about Jesus, how often Jesus asks a question to people that you think he doesn't need to ask. You know, often Jesus will see somebody who, obviously, so there'll be a blind person like Bartimaeus, or there'll be a man who can't walk, and Jesus will say to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" Now, I read that and I think, well, Jesus, why do you need to ask that? It's obvious. Bartimaeus wants to see. The man sitting by the wall, he wants to be able to walk again. You don't need to ask them, Jesus, what they need. Why does he ask that, though? Because he wants that person to recognize that only Jesus can heal them. That only Jesus can give them what they need, can give their sight back, can help them to walk again. And that by verbalizing that and saying, "I want to be able to see," or "I want to be able to walk," they are verbalizing their dependence on Jesus. And this is what Nehemiah is doing here. "Today, I want you to grant me success with the king who I'm going to see." Nehemiah is saying to God, "I need you. I need you to do this." Rebuilding often starts with specific prayer. You know, it says in James 4, he writes, "You do not have because you do not ask God." And I wonder if there's something in this for you and for me today. If we want Jesus to rebuild things in our lives, if we want him to renew things in our lives, we need to ask him. We need to be specific. So I wonder if we don't have because we don't ask. We're too general. We're just saying to him, "Well, would you bless me? Would you do good things in my life?" And maybe there's a call for us here to be specific in what we want God to do. Do you want God to rebuild and renew in your life? Then ask him. Is there something you want him to heal? Then ask him and be specific. "God, would you heal my stomach? God, would you heal my hearing? God, would you heal my foot?" Be specific. Is there a relationship you want him to mend and renew? Then say, "Would you renew my relationship? Would you rebuild it with this person?" Is there a sin that you're struggling with that you just can't resist? Then ask him and be specific. "Would you help me to resist this?" And name it. Do you want God to refresh your faith? Maybe, like me, sometimes you look back and you go, "Well, I used to be on fire for God 20 years ago. I used to read the Bible and it used to speak to me. I used to seek God and I would hear him, but now I feel dry." If that's you, why don't you ask him? You do not have because you do not ask. Say, "God, I want to be on fire for you again, like I was when I was 18, when I was 25, when I was 30. Be specific, because in doing that, we're recognizing our dependence on him. Only you can do this, God. Just like Nehemiah did. Rebuilding starts when we ask. When we ask him and we are specific. You know, Jesus is never mentioned in the book of Nehemiah. In fact, the Messiah, a coming Messiah, isn't ever mentioned in what Nehemiah writes. But the whole message of this book, and you'll see this over the coming weeks, is that we need a Messiah. And we need Jesus. You know, so much of the Old Testament is like that, isn't it? Where we read about human efforts to rebuild or renew or to live their lives in the way that God wants them to follow the law, yet they fail. And I don't want to give things away, but you know, the walls of Jerusalem do get rebuilt in the book of Nehemiah. But as a people, the story of Nehemiah, they end up failing again. And it's almost like this whole book, this whole journal that Nehemiah has written for us, is saying that we need somebody else. Human effort can go so far, but we need a Messiah. We need Jesus. We need somebody from outside of us to come and transform us from the inside out. We don't contain it within ourselves. We need God to come and make his home within us. We need Jesus. And rebuilding starts with Jesus. Yes, grief is important and prayer is important, but both of these things need to take place with Jesus at the centre. Jesus, you see, is the bigger and the better Nehemiah. He's somebody who was also living in a royal palace, a bit like Nehemiah was. Jesus was living in the royal heavens with his Father. Jesus, like Nehemiah, is somebody who lives far away, who wasn't close to where the problem was. But Jesus came, and we're told he took on flesh. He travelled to the place of brokenness, just like Nehemiah does later. He comes to us. He comes to us in our brokenness. Jesus is the better Nehemiah, who we can turn to today. The one who doesn't rebuild walls, but the one who rebuilds us. We need to ask him into our lives, into our grief. We say to him, help us to grieve as we should. We need to ask him into our prayers so we can persevere with them and stop and be with him and seek him before we rush on. We need to invite him into our prayer life so we can ask him specifically what we want his help with and his rebuilding and renewing help with. Ask him. Ask him now. Say, Jesus, come and be the centre of my life as we seek to rebuild in so many ways. Jesus, come and be the centre.